Let me begin by passing out some propaganda this morning. If you'll pass that on back. We'll use that.
Is this a blue one?
Pardon me?
No, that's different. Never mind.
This is different. We're going to use this one a little bit later on in the session this morning. Topic for today is the Christian and the church in the political world. What's proper? What's appropriate? Where are we? A story in the New York Times a couple of years ago began with these words, quote, "Abandoning a long-held belief that political activism is incompatible with their faith, ultra-conservative evangelical Christians are forming a growing new force that is affecting elections and government at federal, state, and local levels. Organized in great part by television preachers and driven by a belief that a moral and spiritual decline is endangering the nation, hundreds of thousands of evangelicals have registered to vote in a drive to support conservative candidates, most under the Republican label." Unquote. A couple of months ago, there was a front page story in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune reporting on the fact that one of the city council members in Minneapolis had given up membership in her party. And it says this: "She also leveled a blast at single-issue fundamentalists, the born-again Christians, whom she believes are taking over the party. Carlson said that the fundamentalists use their religious and moral views in judging others politically. They've called delegates from the precinct caucuses, people who have been loyal party members for many, many years, and asked if they were born-again Christians. I can't represent people who base political decisions on such things. The very idea of doing that is reprehensible to me and to the principles that the party has always stood for," she said. Well, I think that some of the most touted news from the religious community in the last several years has been this involvement of born-again Christians in the political process. Some of us have some serious misgivings about the manner of that political involvement, because we believe that it represents a particular political, or it represents an identification, really, of the Christian faith with a particular political ideology or a particular political program and point of view. And I think that there are some urgent theological reasons for rejecting that close identification, either on the right or on the left, with Christianity and a particular political ideology. But I think that there is massive ambivalence and confusion in the churches about whether and how to be involved politically, and whether and how to be involved in other ways to deal with social problems and social hurts. If we seek to avoid an easy identification of Christianity with a particular political ideology, I think we must be at least equally aware of the opposite and historically much more entrenched danger of simply separating our religious commitments from our political and social involvements. Social ministry in our churches has been generally understood to mean forms of charity and institutional service. Most social ministry committees of churches or congregations, for example, have given little thought to the possibility of Christians working together for some kind of systemic change, changing the systems that either produce or fail to correct problems. We have not thought about attempting such changes either individually or corporately. There has been little theological reflection in the churches about the political realm or as an arena where the church might have some kind of legitimate ministry. Now, I think there have been reasons for that. Some theological reasons, some cultural reasons. Theologically, salvation in the churches has often been understood to mean something very spiritual and very private. The personal and the social dimensions of faith have frequently been separated. The material world and social involvement has sometimes been regarded as contaminating, and Christian faith has been reserved for some other spiritual dimension of our lives. Dr. Lloyd Svensby, who is the president of Luther Northwestern Seminaries, in his doctoral dissertation, writes about the response of Lutherans to the social gospel movement earlier in this century, and he says this, quote, "The root of all troubles facing man in the minds of most Lutherans lay in personal and individual sin. From this fact, the church was to take its clue as to the remedy for the human predicament. Correction for the malady, Lutherans contended, could come only by preaching law and gospel to the individual sinner to bring him to repentance. Only when this was accomplished, the argument continued, was the church coming to grips with the real issue." Unquote. I would contend, on the basis of a study that I did of some of the official Lutheran church magazines during the 1950s, that this kind of exclusive concern for the personal regeneration of the individual has been with us until very recently as the viewpoint of the overwhelming majority in the church, and is still very much present also today. Secondly, I believe that a misunderstanding of the American system of separation of church and state has led to a false separation between the so-called spiritual and temporal spheres of human existence. The effect of such misunderstanding has been to enhance secularism in our country through the divorce of Christian faith from social and political or worldly concerns. Religion has come to be thought of as kind of a personal, private matter, and we have separated moral judgment from public policy. We've sometimes gotten the mistaken notion that our moral judgments have to be separated totally from what's happening over in this other realm of public policy. Thirdly, I think the corporate social responsibility of the churches has been limited largely to charity and to caring for individual victims of misfortune. Lutheran churches particularly, I think, have been exemplary in their commitment to social services, social agencies of one kind or another. In former years, we built orphanages. We've built homes for the aged. We've developed agencies to help care for the down and out. Lutheran churches have maintained an unusually high number of caring institutions and agencies and specialized chaplaincies. We've been exceptionally active in dealing with the victims of social disorder, such as care for the refugees, for instance. But Lutherans have been reluctant to deal with social change, to deal with things like advocacy or systemic reform. A fourth theological reason for a rather narrow view of social ministry, at least among us Lutherans, has been the neglect theologically of what Luther called the civil use of the law. In dealing with social problems, there's been the tendency to stress exclusively the regenerative power of the gospel for the individual Christian, who then, in some vague way, is automatically expected to make his or her moral influence felt in society. The gospel has been offered as the final solution to social problems, with the unavoidable inference that the alleviation of social problems has to await a positive response to evangelism. We've proceeded on the assertion that the only way to change conditions in society is first of all to change the hearts of people. The editor of the former Lutheran Herald, which was the official church magazine of the old Evangelical Lutheran Church, for example, explained his reticence in the 50s for making much comment on what he called the race problem, expressing his conviction that, quote, our present task is simply to proclaim the gospel, which, when all is said and done, affords the only solution to all the problems of mankind, and therefore to this one also, unquote. See what's involved here. The unavoidable inference was that improvement in race relations would have to await a positive response to evangelism. He said, quote, if we can kneel together, we can live together. Until we can learn to kneel together, we shall never learn to live together. It is that simple, unquote. To which anybody, I would suggest, who knew very much about Luther's theology should simply have said, that's hogwash. And yet that statement was not at all atypical. It summarizes in just a few brief sentences the fundamental attitude of most writers in the church magazines during the period of the 50s that I studied. The civil use of the law, that is, using law to restrain sin and to force some kind of approximation of justice in society, was neglected or often even repudiated. I remember some of the articles where people were talking about certain labor problems, labor unrest that was going on during this period. And there was a good deal of exhortation to the Christian management to be decent in the way in which they treated laborers, that sort of thing. But law, resorting to law of any sort was a terrible kind of thing that ought not to happen, these writers believed. And there appears to have been often little concern about communicating or cooperating with non-Christians for the purpose of improving social conditions on the basis of some kind of law. This neglect of the civil use of the law, I think, represents one of the most fundamental theological reasons for our somewhat narrow understanding of the church's role in society, which has just been a part of the history of Lutheran churches in this country. Now, in addition to these theological reasons for a narrow approach to social ministry, I think there are also certain societal forces at work which serve to reinforce this understanding of the church's role. There's, first of all, a pervasive individualism in our society. While the notion of rugged individualism is being challenged in many ways today, I think it's still a strong strand in our cultural outlook. And it provides cultural support for the heresy of privatism in the realm of faith. Second, the last decade or so has seen a strong emphasis on introspection in our society. People have turned inward to examine what's inside themselves, rather than looking outward to the problems in society and trying to solve them. Many writers have commented on the new forms of narcissism or inwardness in our society, with an emphasis on self-fulfillment and a general withdrawal from the public and collective world. As I said a couple of days ago, maybe one of the best pieces of evidence for that phenomenon in our society is simply to stroll through any bookstore and observe the number of books there that are devoted to getting what's mine at whatever expense to you may be necessary. This current emphasis, social emphasis, on the realization of my personal potential can easily be absorbed into the agenda of the church with a corresponding disregard or even lack of energy for social responsibility or social ministry. Thirdly, I think that we're living through a time of some disillusionment with public life and with political solutions to problems. It may be that a general lack of confidence in government and in collective solutions generally to problems has damaged the commitment of church people to engage in social action. While political action is undoubtedly required for dealing with many forms of injustice in our society, disillusionment with old solutions has weakened the will of many, I think, to work in this area. And finally, our society is characterized by a diversity of political and social views, and we have not learned very well how to be comfortable with such diversity in the church. We often fear an open discussion of viewpoints for fear that diversity of viewpoints will lead to conflict and a fracturing of the unity of the church or of a congregation. And we may shy away from social problems and social ministry simply because we want to avoid that kind of controversy. Yet despite these theological misunderstandings, I think, and cultural impediments, Christians are called to be involved in social ministry and in political activity. As Christians, we believe that we live between the times, in the now of the fallen creation, ruled indeed by the law, and in the not yet of the kingdom of God through faith in the gospel. Our faith in the gospel frees us from the paralysis of concern for self and propels us to works of love and service for the neighbor. The gospel frees us to participate in solving social and political problems. Such involvement is part of our Christian vocation, part of our calling to serve the neighbor also in this way. Now, the gospel, of course, does not provide us with answers to the many contemporary issues of our society. It doesn't provide any blueprints which we can then label as being somehow Christian. In fact, whenever people have claimed to establish the kingdom of God on earth on the basis of the gospel, they have turned the gospel into a new form of law, and the arrogant assumptions of such people have often led to new tyrannies in the political order. But the gospel reminds us that it is as forgiven sinners that we participate also in political life. And that's very important because it protects us from false hopes, on the one hand, and it protects us from false despair, on the other. Because we know that sin is pervasive in the world, Christians can participate in politics with fewer illusions concerning the possibilities of political achievement. There's greater realism concerning the ambiguities of political life. We're aware that no political solution, for instance, will ever be perfect, because no political solution ever extricates us from our involvement in sin. But the gospel also safeguards us against an equally tempting false despair, which may threaten to overwhelm us as we try to engage in politics. George Farrell, I think, has put it very well when he puts it this way, quote, "A great many of our contemporaries who have lost faith in the utopias of yesterday, which were to establish perfect justice, are now convinced that the futopias, the brave new world of Huxley, or the 1984 of George Orwell, is to be the fate of man. According to them," he goes on, "we are being driven toward this utopia by an inexorable fate, and every effort to avoid this political hell only hastens the day of its coming. Against this despair," he says, "which characterizes so much of political thinking of contemporary intellectuals, the Christian depends upon the resources of the gospel. In the means of grace, God offers him the forgiveness of sins, which alone can enable him to act courageously and confidently in the midst of the ambiguities of political life. Of course, he will not escape sin. His actions in the realm of politics will involve him in injustice, pride, and all sorts of evil. But even though devils all the world should fill, all seeking to devour us, we tremble not, we fear no ill, they shall not overpower us. Recognize that line? The gospel frees the Christian from despair and for responsible and intelligent action in the realm of politics. Because we know of the forgiveness of sins, the sins which do surround us in the life of politics cannot frighten us into inaction or and despair. Thus, for the Christian, the gospel, far from being irrelevant to politics, becomes the chief resource of our political life. Unquote. Okay, we live as Christians out of the gospel. But along with all other people, Christians and non-Christians alike, we are also addressed by God's law, also in our political life. Because we live in an imperfect world, a world that will always be marked by sin and self-centeredness, love for the neighbor has to take the form of a search for justice. And justice is a law word. We must be concerned about laws that will regulate society in the most humane and just fashion. We must concern ourselves with the support of social structures that genuinely serve the common welfare. The church cannot avoid this dimension of its ministry. As Lutheran theologian William Lazarus has put it, quote, God is the living Lord of all of life. To exclude the crucial realm of politics from Christian thought and action is not merely ecclesiastical apathy. It is ultimately theological heresy and ethical disobedience, unquote. Now the question is, how or in what ways can we as the church, corporately even, discharge our responsibilities in this area? Through what kinds of roles does the church carry out its ministry in society? What are some of the ways that we fulfill our responsibilities in this area? I'd like to suggest a number of them, and we can perhaps add some later. First of all, we're involved in this area in ways that are somewhat indirect and yet extremely important. First of all, I would list the whole matter of worship, something which is totally central to the life of the church. But what really happens in worship? In worship, we place all of our life, all of our contemporary life, within the context of the divine human encounter. To do that is to change us and to change our outlook on life because we see it under the lordship of God. This is what's involved, at least in part, through our prayers of intercession. One of the things that we do for the political order is to pray for the political order as part of our worship. The church also serves as a social critic. Now we may get a little bit more nervous about this one, but the church is called to sort of call society to account for the ways in which it promotes or fails to promote justice and peace and human well-being. That's what the proclamation of the law is all about. That's what the prophets in the Old Testament were constantly doing. They were calling the people to account for the way in which they were being unjust to their neighbors in their society. The church as a social critic. Thirdly, the church can serve as an advocate. Seeking justice for the neighbor through laws and structures of society. Speaking out on the neighbor's behalf. There's a difference between being an advocate and a lobbyist. A lobbyist seeks to promote something which may be very legitimate for himself or herself or their institution. An advocate speaks on behalf of somebody else. And it is the church, one of the church's functions, to speak on behalf of those who may not have the power to speak in our society. The church can serve as a teacher, addressing itself in a considered way to some of the public issues, and thus enlightening and aiding its members in their role as citizens. The church provides for the services of the pastoral ministry, offering pastoral care to those who do carry out social ministry through their daily occupations and vocations. The church serves as a partner often in this enterprise of social ministry, collaborating with other agencies in the community to serve and support those who suffer deprivation or injustice. The church has often functioned as a pioneer in some areas of social ministry. If you look at what's going on, what's been taken over in our society in the whole realm of health care, for instance, or in the whole realm of education, you know that those were realms that originally started with the church. And then after it got going, it was taken over in the public realm. The church today is involved in things like refugee service. There are these areas in which the church has served as a pioneer, and so that later on then it can be picked up and carried on simply as part of the social responsibility of the political order. I think very importantly, the church can serve as a forum for the discussion of various viewpoints in hammering out solutions to political issues. Certainly in the church, where we recognize that we are accepted and accept one another on the basis of the gospel, we ought to be free to express different viewpoints in this realm of law, in this realm of social justice. And the church can provide, ought to be able to provide a kind of forum for that kind of discussion of views to happen. The church also, I would say inescapably, serves as a corporate agent for some kinds of social change, because the church exercises a certain kind of clout, even economic clout, in our social order. And that's unavoidable, I would contend. We don't have a decision about whether or not we can do that. If you want to come back to that after a while in the discussion, I'd be glad to talk some more about that. But the way in which the church corporately invests its monies for pensions, for instance, for the pensions of its clergy, it has to invest them somewhere. And by the very decisions that it makes about where it will make those investments, it exercises a certain kind of clout in society. Well, I passed around some sections of a little pamphlet that I wrote some years ago called Christian Social Responsibility. And I would like to take a few minutes in concluding my remarks in this session to read through a few sections of this pamphlet in the hopes that it might spark again some additional thoughts.
Are there more of those?
Yes, there should be about 50 of them around. Turn to page 2. Under heading B there, Responsibility of the Christian Individual. What I want to do is look at certain paragraphs under that section of the responsibility of the individual, and then go over and take a look at our corporate responsibility. But on page 2, paragraph 1 there, Christians understand the temporal realm as God's creation, where a fallen world is sustained, is preserved by God's sustaining care. Therefore, they do not withdraw from the world, but strive to serve as agents of God's purpose within the world. They serve God's cause of social justice through their secular offices as citizens, family members, workers, and community members. Christians living in a democracy are inescapably involved in the political process. You see, we have different responsibilities from those who lived in the Middle Ages or back in the times of the Roman Empire, because we are a part of a democratic process in this country. Actively or passively, they participate through the processes of politics to help shape the laws and structures of society. Service in the public sphere is a channel through which Christians express a part of their call from God. And let's jump down to paragraph 6 on the next page. Compromise, sometimes thought of as a bad word, but compromise is an inevitable part of the give and take of political or other social participation. Compromise involves the process of achieving a meeting of the minds, an acceptable consensus, a workable reconciliation of conflict or of diverse views. Such compromise moves toward wholesome, mutually desired goals. It accepts the possible as a step toward the desirable. Seen in this light, compromise can be an expression of respect for persons and community. It may require one to yield some self-centered advantage for the sake of others and the good of the community. Outwardly, the social and political involvement of Christians differs little from that of their non-Christian neighbors. Indeed, the two can and must work closely together for human justice, because we're in the realm of law. Law belongs to everybody, whether you're Christians or non-Christians. The practice of politics has no uniquely Christian properties. Christians in political activity differ, however, in the spiritual resources available to them, their motivations to service, their reasons for the goals to which they commit themselves, their understanding of human failure, and their experience of the reality of grace and forgiveness. That's what I tried to say a bit earlier. Now let's jump down to the corporate responsibility on page 4. The corporate responsibility of the church in the civic realm has many aspects, ranging from indirect to direct involvement. Well, you see that already in the list of things that I put on the board. The ministry and fellowship of the church provides persons' lives with the kind of meaning which propels them towards service to the neighbor. Christian has a different vision, ought to have a different vision, that propels towards the neighbor. Christian instruction fosters a commitment to values which serve the common good. The church can help to inspire and shape political virtues and public ideals. Church members can form voluntary organizations to address specific needs. At certain times, the church may advocate particular social reforms. The corporate church, and I think now paragraph 2 is a fairly significant one, the corporate church needs to correct false divisions often made between sacred and secular, spiritual and earthly. The church and its members inescapably are involved in politics. Doing nothing really serves to support the status quo. Politics is the process in which people express God's grant of His authority to the church and its members, to God's authority to foster whatever is good and to curb whatever is evil in society. The influence of the church and its members needs always to be a witness for honesty, integrity, justice, wholeness in the community, and the other ingredients basic to the sound society. Well, then in the next section, I list again some of those specific things that the church can do. We can study the issues, we can evaluate the effects of certain actions or political policies on the community. We can try to bring a biblical and theological perspective to bear on some of the issues. We can try to clarify the goals of certain projected legislation, for instance, we ought to resist the effort to make the church captive to a particular class, political, economic, racial, national, or ideological interest. I list again in number four, advocacy on behalf of the poor, helping to formulate sound public policy goals, joining in corporate ventures with cooperation, and using corporate purchasing power as a means of economic clout. Then paragraph five, every act of the corporate church is a witness, whether it is addressing its own members or those outside its membership. In a complex society, any corporate witness in the civic realm demands thorough study and analysis of the issues. The church also realizes that its witness cannot and ought not be imposed upon those who dissent. While a public witness is an inescapable part of the church's ministry, this witness must be made in the context of conversation, persuasion, reciprocal correction, and mutual encouragement. The corporate church seeks within its own fellowship to be an exemplary community. Confessing its sinfulness, the church relies upon God's forgiveness offered in the gospel. It seeks healing and reconciliation among its own members and strives to reach out in love and justice toward those outside its fellowship. Okay, I'll stop with that and open it up now for your concerns or comments.
Just one thing that Bert Lanson says, the church also realizes that if this witness cannot not be imposed upon those in the sin. I think any time you're getting involved in political process, at times your will, like let's say if the church is supporting some law, or its members are in the last pass, it's going to be imposing its will upon those people who dissent in an indirect way, maybe not directly, but that's going to happen.
Well, let me distinguish what I'm talking about at that point. What you describe is really the political process in which, in some way, the majority rules. And that's in the realm of law and the Christian, and the church, the Christian as an individual, the church as an institution, participates in that process like any other institution. And in that sense, doesn't claim some privileged position for itself as a church. What I have in mind in this statement is rather something of what I see going on in some places where the church says, this is the Christian answer, and therefore, because it's the Christian answer, it must be accepted by everyone, or we ought to somehow, there's a kind of a romantic longing for almost the Puritan arrangements of New England where it was some rule of the elect. Not have some Christian blueprint for social action.
I think the key word there is impose. In other words, you cannot impose your thoughts on another person, but you can, as a salesman, persuade.
Yeah.
And I think that is the difference between what you're suggesting here and what is the force of law.
There was another, yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of an impatient type of person with the church, so that's the basis of where I'm coming from. And I look at, the document, what you say, as a situation that I could envision the church in 1880 also saying, relative to the problems with the split country and, and the civil problems and the westward expansion and problems that we're having. And I see it kind of as a thing that's looking at the church as a structure for things to happen. And I think like what you mentioned very early, the new wave church, you might say, the way that they came at it through the media. And some way or other, they disseminated knowledge in a way that really grabbed hold of people. And I think my own sense is, we may have missed, in a sense, a media that was there, and they grabbed onto it. They grabbed a lot of people and the hearts and the political life, really, of the people. And I think right now, with the electronics going further into computerization, we should probably, my estimation, be thinking in terms of
whole tremendous amounts of knowledge. What kind of knowledge is are we going to give to people in the kind of, well, I think with the charisma, the leadership of the church, you know, like the you know, if indeed the bishops of the Lutheran Church or whatever are saying certain things, that ought to get clearly to everybody that that is their thoughts. Now, I don't say that we have to buy into it, but I think, you know, be told we have to buy into it. I think the dissemination of knowledge is going to be the power that we're going to have to deal with, and the media still is going to be important. But I think, too, just like right now, the fundamentalists are just getting computerless and all of this stuff, you know, that are they're going gung-ho on this thing. And I think I see us as kind of dealing yet with 1880s kinds of structures in some way. And I'm concerned about that because I think we don't grab on quick enough to the media and to maybe this whole idea of the concept of knowledge rather than the concept of you mentioned corporate monies and stuff like that. And using that, I think maybe we have to look at it in the direction.
Well, yeah, boy, you really open up a whole nest of things. Let me make a few comments. First of all, let me clarify. I didn't mean to suggest in the beginning of my remarks that I somehow had a problem with the involvement of the fundamentalist Christians in politics. I think they should, I applaud their involvement. What I have some disagreement about is their easy identification of Christianity with a particular ideological point of view. And I think that we have to keep Christianity in tension with whatever ideology happens to be on. Because Christianity, otherwise you lose the basis from which to serve as a social critic if you identify with a particular ideology, and then that gets in, and then what? You know, then you're simply part of it. But I think what I'm suggesting is not what the church would have been doing in 1880, for this simple reason, particularly, and now I'll draw on Lutheran heritage in this area. We've had in our heritage one of the most remarkable insights of Luther, which has gotten distorted all very badly. But it's this whole notion of two kingdoms, that there is a spiritual kingdom and a secular kingdom. That is, there is. We are related in one way to God, and we are related in another way to the neighbor. Historically, what has happened in the Lutheran churches is that these got separated into two separate kind of realms. The church was over here in the spiritual realm and dealt with spiritual matters. The state was over here in the secular realm and dealt with secular matters. And sort of ne'er the twain shall meet. The church must be blind to whatever goes on over here. I think you have to make the distinction between spiritual and secular. I think that's what Luther was trying to do. But they're always in a creative tension with one another. So that, for instance, the church is always in a position to serve as a critic precisely because it recognizes that all of life, including the state, whatever, is finally under the lordship of God. And therefore, there is always something that is able to show up the inadequacies of whatever arrangements we have developed, okay? So the church, I think, right down through Germany in the 30s and 40s, held to this kind of perversion of Luther's two kingdoms doctrine, which kept them from serving as that social critic, except on the part of certain people like the confessing church in Germany. But I think, now I guess I would, you said you were an impatient person. I think two things in that respect. One is it is easier for an individual than for a corporate body to be prophetic. Whenever you're dealing with a corporate group, you always have difficulty of developing some kind of consensus first. And that will never be quite as sharp in its prophetic edge as an individual can be. But I think we're doing better at it. I think we're doing better at it. I think, for instance, that when the bishops of the ALC a few months ago made their trip to Central America and came back, they put together things like video tapes, film strips, I've been at district conventions where time has been set aside for them to talk about what they saw there and offer their observations in a way, in an attempt to, I suppose, persuade people to a different perspective or a different view of what's going on. But it is slow. Whenever we deal corporately, it's always a slow process.
I guess my feeling is that, okay, I think that was just so great, you know, that happened, but I think that, you know, some way getting it out there, because I think the electronic church,
yeah,
they know how to get it out there so
sure,
quick
that different...
Oral Roberts is right there now doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure exactly, you know,
when,
in what realm, where we were going to get the break from that.
Yeah, I hear you. When we, for instance, put out a statement like this, or any of the other statements of the church, that's a very slow process. It involves getting together a consultation of people, then writing a first draft, then sending it out to all of the congregations for study, getting their responses, writing a second draft, running it through the standing committee of an office, through the church council, through the convention, at any of which points, you know, it can be changed. It is a slow process, and that's very frustrating, and I don't know anybody who doesn't become impatient at that point. But the other side of the coin is that once you have done that, it's easier for the church generally to accept as its own what's there, rather than saying, oh, that's just somebody who had a great idea up there and it doesn't mean anything to me, he doesn't speak for me. Well, maybe he doesn't speak for you anyway, but at least it's taken more seriously.
I'll get start by an example. This may sound rather naive, but Pope John Paul II, he's done a considerable amount of political activism.
Yeah.
He has met with Yasser Arafat. He has met with the Western leaders, Thatcher and all the rest. He has gone into the different churches trying to, I don't know what he's trying to do, I won't say that, but I know what he is doing, I think. But he has worked with all of these people. I mean, he would talk to Idi Amin or Gaddafi or anyone, as well as President Reagan. He wants to deal with all of these people. And when he does it, I don't believe we look at it as being a political movement, as much as what I think we're talking about, the very basis of this, all that we would do is to follow what God tells us we must do. In our actions and reactions, two things we must do, that is love and forgive. And Paul deals with this, or Pope John Paul II, he deals with this continually. You see this in the quotes, and you see this how it comes out. Now, when we become involved with social action and political advocacy, which I'm all for, we must do that, and unfortunately, we have to work through the system, which means you have committees, which means you have all of these various types of individual organizations working for the same end, but under different headings, our Lutheran Church, a Catholic Church, this and that. Through it all, I believe the basis of what we are really trying to do never comes out, and that is that we are trying to live in a world in love and forgiveness. That's the basis of our meeting with someone. That's the basis of our meeting or wanting change. And I think it may sound naive, but it's something that does not come through. We come through as a political group, and not clearly to anyone like love and forgiveness. That's not a Christian thing. I mean, the humanists can have the same thing. All people will react to this and they'll understand the basic thought. I think Gaddafi will understand the basic thought, although he'll probably work with some of it. But the thing is, this is what I think we lose in our Christian advocacy, and this is what I think is lost by the television conservatives, Christian conservatives, is this never comes through. There, instead of this coming through, what comes through is that we have to change to this way. You know, they're making definite goals that men are going to change, and this has never worked in the past. It's not going to work in the future. It's just like war, you know, we're always going to have it as long as we think traditionally. Now, a new thought, a completely new thought has to blow up. And I think that's the way it is in our advocacy. And the completely new thought is the oldest thought, love and forgiveness. Now, I don't mean that we're all going to run around saying, hey, let's all love and forgive each other. No. But I mean, when we meet with people and when we deal with people of all persuasions, they must recognize very clearly where we're coming from. And we're coming from the very basis of what runs through the entire Bible. There's no exception, love and forgiveness.
I would say that some of that, because it's in the realm of law, we share also with the common humanity. I think that the concern for love, as it expresses itself in the search for justice, is a part also of law. What lies underneath the law also finally is law. You know, it's the end toward which law points. And I think a good example of what you're talking about is the involvement of Christians and churches in the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s, where if you simply relied upon proclaiming the gospel, that is, people ought to love and forgive one another, I think you'd wait a long time.
You wouldn't get anywhere.
That's right. You have to start with a concern for law, which says we can coerce people to live in a certain way that approximates judgment, even if they don't feel like it. And then that's for everybody's benefit in society, we said. Now, we also, and this is what I hear you saying, we also ought to be clear that we don't stop there, that we move beyond it to also the realm of forgiveness and the gospel and all that will mean in terms of changed personal relationships.
Yes. Yeah, you don't want to just trade. Make a trade-off.
Yeah.
Law for law.
Yeah. Okay. That's
not very
good. I'd like to ask a question and about the position of the church in the modern world of communication. As I can recall, back in history, the pen was mightier than the sword, always has. In the early days, the party or the group that controlled communication, writing, art, graphics, was the church, and they had a greater influence on society than some of the other disciplines of the time, whether they were the kings or the barber baron or whoever. Over the years, this dominance of communication has drifted, and in our society now it's dominated by salesmanship, by advertising, by other forms of money, of getting money and using. And I've been wondering if there's any way that the church, after researching and conferencing and agreeing on the proper, the right, justice, justifiable position, cannot take a more aggressive position in transmitting this information through our present electronic age, is what this gentleman suggested over here. And how far can we go to be more effective?
Yeah. Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think we've done nearly what we could do in the whole communication area. A problem, of course, is that kind of communication is extremely expensive.
Well, okay. So it's a sacrifice you must make. If we need it.
Yeah. Peg?
But there's another way that it can be done, and I'd just like to ask any of you, how many of you write to your congressman or your senator when you feel that there's an issue up that is very important to you? Do any of you? I do. And I think this is where the church is missing a bit. I think that they could very well ask or suggest to the various congregations that when an issue comes up like abortion and the church has taken a stand on it, or a nuclear freeze or whatever, and they've taken a stand on it, that they urge their members to write to their senators and their congressmen. Anyone can do that. Don't do it as a group. Do it as individuals, because that's where the strength lies.
I think this is the point that I was trying to make, is that with many different groups right now, the NRA has computerless, you have various interest groups, but I don't really think we know those people. You know, Lutheranism have a particular viewpoint that would, you know, maybe could be given the knowledge, and then they can transmit this through the policy.
And of course, it would have to be done in a careful way, so that, I mean, people's names on, you don't like to see your name on a list that you don't know it's going to appear on. And congregations have had to be very careful about giving out lists of their membership, because after all, the list of membership is probably gone. But
maybe
it can be done. It can
maybe
be
voluntary.
People who are interested, who
not
might
not
be.
Not congregations, never. Because the congressmen, we listen, we know this from experience. They do listen to individual
letters,
communication. card, letter, as long as they know it's from their paper.
Yeah.
And if you can get a large group of individuals who are not the congregation, because that is a forced influence.
You give your precinct number and the whole thing. I've done it many times.
We don't elect that many stupid people. They may be dull, but they're not.
Let's say they're politically sensitive.
That's right.
there also is what might be called a combination of an identity and an ecclesiological problem with regard to media coverage. John Paul makes a trip somewhere in the country, but it's front page, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, you know, Minneapolis Star, all over the place. I wonder if anyone can think of a time when James Crumway or David Preuss, for example, made a trip somewhere in the world and made the front pages of all the newspapers. The image simply isn't there. You know, who's David Preuss? But John Paul, everyone knows who that is.
That's true.
The Chicago television media, at Christmas or Easter, they are always at Holy Name Cathedral covering the services. I have yet in 9.5 years in that area to see them show up at any other denomination.
You should live in the Northwest.
Yeah, it does make a difference where you are. But another, a perfect example of what you're saying, I don't mean to suggest that mandate for peacemaking thing comes near to the complexity and thoroughness of the Catholic bishop's statement. But the conclusions are very similar. Yeah, our statement was a couple of years before the Catholic bishop statement, and the Catholic bishop statement got all the press.
We have a better PR department.
The answer would be for all of us to become Catholic. This spring, we went to a conference in Seattle on the Barman Declaration. That it's the 50th anniversary, and one thing the signers of that declaration by the Confessing Church during the Hitler years said that the church gave them no equipment before that time in any way to protest. You know, it was just totally out of their realm, and it was something so totally new. And how can the church today teach people that while we do participate in government, we do participate in democracy and advocacy to be ready for when do we know when the time would come to actually, as a church or as Christians, say no? And I'm wondering, are we giving any more equipment than they were receiving? Or what can we do to help each other to know that? Do you know what I mean?
At a most theoretical level. You know, in our theology, I think we've moved beyond where they were then.
Yeah.
I think we've overcome fairly well at least, some of that false division created by the misrepresentation of Two Kingdoms theology. I happen to be a Two Kingdoms person. I think it has marvelous possibilities for understanding the relationship between Christian faith and political order. If it's understood as a tension, we always have trouble with paradoxes and tension. We like to just put things in boxes, and that's what happened to that as well. But at a more practical level, which is what I think I hear you asking also in part, we are having difficulty. I suppose one of the ways we try to do it is through picking up on given topics, for instance, that the church will corporately study and address and work on as issues. And those come, you know, those aren't just something that somebody dreams up in Minneapolis or New York or wherever. They're usually items that have come through the grassroots, through district and synod convention resolutions that get forwarded on to the national and finally referred over for some kind of action if people believe that it's a significant enough kind of issue. So there is that kind of help the church tries to give. Again, I think we have a problem of communication oftentimes. I have found many of these statements to be helpful as the basis for adult forum discussions on Sunday mornings in churches. I don't know how many churches do that. Maybe if we put it in a different kind of thing, like videotapes, we would make it more palatable to start discussions, etc. I have to call it quits.
Let me just say one thing.
Yes.
This happens every time we talk about something like this. we are always concerned about communication and what the other guy is saying, we're not able to communicate. But very rarely do I hear the tremendous advantage of them being able to communicate well, that we can listen to what they have to say and use what we hear and learn. And we don't talk about that very much. We're always talking about what we want to say, but never what we're going to hear. And I think it's kind of sad.
Yeah.
There's two very good points, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.